Okay, so this talk is a little different, and I notice we're starting 5 minutes late. The good thing is that there will not be a discussion period really for this talk, because there won't be anything to discuss yet. What I'll try to do basically is give you a very broad introduction to essentially the whole conference. Now, I'll do that in a slightly biased way, because I am a theorist and I like to work on dynamical modeling of clusters, so I will sort of concentrate on what I think are the key dynamics questions in the field. But I'll be broad in the sense that I'll try to cover all three areas of the meeting. These are the three areas we intended to target. The first one is the sort of detailed dynamical modeling of individual clusters. This is these days typically using some combination of n-body simulations and stellar evolution, stellar modeling. The second one is looking more particularly at compact objects in global clusters, and here it's not just galactic clusters, but also more and more these days X-ray binaries in extragalactic clusters. And then the third general area is the formation of global clusters and the study of global cluster systems, which really has a much more of an extragalactic component. And the structure of the talk is very simple. I have three slides, one for each area, okay? And I'll just tell you what I think are the important current questions that hopefully some people will be addressing and that I think we should be discussing at the meeting. And I'll try to be, it's 9 in the morning, kind of a bit early, but I'll try to be lively and provocative, and I will probably be insulting lots of you. The difficult thing about giving a talk like this is for every question that I will mention, of course, there are probably 5 people in the audience who think they've answered that question perfectly in their last paper. So there might be a bit of hostility. Let's see how it goes. So let me try with the first area, dynamical modeling of individual clusters. This has traditionally been really focusing on galactic clusters. We'll cover that basically all day today, and with a little bit of additional talks on Thursday and Friday. So here I want to make sort of a provocative and somewhat pessimistic statement at the beginning. It's certainly true that, you know, after many decades of theoretical work in this field, we now understand very well all the basic physics, the basic pieces that we think might be relevant to the physics of global clusters. And, you know, things like starting in the early days, two-body relaxation, gravothermal contraction, how clusters evolve to core collapse, evaporation through a tidal boundary, and more recently, detailed studies of sort of strong dynamical interaction processes, things like resonant interactions of binaries, physical collisions of stars, all these things that we know must be taking place in dense cores. But if you ask the question, you know, are we now at the point where we can put all these basic pieces together and actually construct detailed quantitative models of global clusters that fit the observations, I think, unfortunately, the answer is very much no. So I asked the question here in my first bullet, do we understand theoretically, even at a basic level, what determines the structural parameters, the observed parameters of global clusters? I would say we're not at all at that stage yet. You might have hoped that by now this field of global cluster modeling would be perhaps at sort of a similar stage to what stellar structure and evolution had reached in the 1950s. You know, having understood, having available all the different pieces of the physics for stars, it was nuclear physics, enough quantum mechanics to understand transport processes and all that, you could put all that together and build models like people were doing for the first time in the 50s for stars, where you can actually compare to observations and find good agreement almost at, you know, the percent level. I think we're nowhere near that stage at the moment for global cluster modeling. Let me tell you a little bit more about, you know, some sort of more specific questions that will be addressed at the meeting. You can ask, well, if we're not there yet, at least do we know what are the key physical ingredients that should go into these models? And there also, I think the answer is no, unfortunately. So let's look at some of them that will be, you know, some potentially important things that will be discussed at the meeting. For many years, starting in the early 90s or so, this became particularly fashionable again. People really thought that primordial binaries would play a very dominant role in explaining, sort of in shaping the dynamical architecture of clusters. And you've all heard this story. It's a wonderful story. It's sort of what attracted me to this field 15 years ago or so. It's the idea that binaries are the fuel of clusters, just like hydrogen is to a star. You've all heard the story. You've all used it probably at some level. You've all told this story in your papers. You know, binary burning. Primordial binaries go to the cores of clusters through inelastic interactions. They produce energy. And that energy production is what allows clusters to maintain themselves in a sort of long-lived, quasi-steady thermal equilibrium state. And they go in that state all the way to the present and become the nice non-core collapsed King models that we see in most clusters. I think that we're unfortunately at a point now where that very nice story probably has to be abandoned to some extent. And there are two reasons for that that will be discussed at the meeting a lot. One is that observers have now measured binary fractions very accurately for a number of clusters. And the binary fractions that you measure are extremely low, maybe 1% in the halo of a cluster typically, a few percent at most, maybe 5% in the cluster core. Now, some people, Harvey is salivating already because we have a bet about this, some people, and I don't count myself as one of those people yet, some people have interpreted these measurements of very low binary fractions today in clusters as implying that the initial primordial binary fractions in clusters must also be very low, as low as 1%. Now realize this is an order of magnitude or two lower than binary fractions that are measured anywhere else for stars. If that were true, I think, you know, 1% binaries initially is just not enough to make binaries a dominant part of the dynamical evolution of clusters. The other thing that has happened, and we're going to hear from John Frigeau about this just later on this morning, is that theorists have also made progress, and we can now build pretty good, I believe, quantitatively accurate models of clusters that are in this sort of equilibrium binary burning phase. And if you look at the properties of these models, they do not match at all the observations. In particular, core radii, sort of a basic structural parameter, core radii that are predicted by these models are typically at least an order of magnitude too small. So it just doesn't work very well. So what else do we have? Well, sort of at the opposite end of the spectrum, going from something that was theoretically extremely appealing, to me at least, to something that would be very disappointing, is that perhaps it's just initial conditions. Okay? Clusters are born with certain parameters such that if you let them undergo this gravothermal contraction, by the time they reach 12 billion years, well, they look like what we see. And it could be even worse than that. Douglas Heggie, in his talk right after mine, will tell you that it may even be the case that if you start two clusters with very similar initial conditions, they might actually become very different things 12 billion years later, just because of statistical fluctuation. And that would be even more, to me, sort of depressing as a theorist. Fortunately, there are many other possibilities. And, you know, on the one hand, it's a little disappointing that I feel like we're sort of going back to the drawing board. But, you know, these many possibilities mean that there's still a lot of fun to be had by theorists. And some of these possibilities will be discussed in talks during the conference. Some are old ideas that have become fashionable again. Some are very new ideas. So in the category of older ideas, there's just mass segregation. In particular, you can look at mass segregation of heavy remnants. Through dynamical friction, they heat the background star. So that's also a source of energy. With black holes, in particular, you can do even more interesting things that various people will talk about, Melvin Davies on Friday. Then there is massive black holes, if they were present at the centers of clusters, would also have a very significant effect on their structural properties. And we'll hear a lot about that. In the category of completely new ideas, Harvey Richard later today will tell you about white dwarf kicks. This is very interesting. The idea that white dwarfs, of course, are born typically near the center of a cluster. That's where the most massive main sequence stars are. If they get kicks when they're born, that means you displace a lot of mass out of the cluster. That's binding energy that the core is losing. and that's also a potentially very significant heating source, effectively. So we'll hear about all of that this week. Let me move on to, I've sort of lumped together here compact objects and other exotic things that we know are formed at high rates in global clusters because of the high densities and because of all these dynamical processes. Here, my feeling of the status is that, you know, there's been amazing, just phenomenal progress at the observational level. I mean, you've all seen these papers where suddenly there's 20 new radio millisecond pulsars found in some cluster. It's true at all levels. X-ray binaries, thanks to Chandra and XMM. Blue stragglers, I will mention at the end here. You know, you look at just the quantity and quality of data on blue stragglers that we have now across many clusters, and it's just amazing. Theory sort of lags, and I would say theorists, in fact, have lagged, I think, more and more. Theoretical models are certainly becoming more detailed. Natasha Ivanova, later today, I believe, this afternoon, will give sort of a status report on this. You only need to take one glance at one of Natasha's very complicated diagrams to realize that, you know, things have also become a lot more complicated. We theorists used to write these nice little papers where we would sort of do one thing, look at one particular dynamical process that we thought was really interesting. And of course we thought, well, it's got to be overwhelmingly dominant and it's got to explain everything. Well, I think it's clear now that it doesn't quite work that way. There's a tremendous variety of these exotic sources that are formed in global clusters. And there's a correspondingly great variety of dynamical processes and whole sequences of dynamical steps and stellar evolution processes that can lead to the formation of these sources. And to understand this theoretically and to build full models of clusters that make predictions for these sources, you really need to have all that complexity in the models. Here's a question I can finally answer yes to. Are there black holes in global clusters? For many years, many of us have been writing papers explaining why there should not be any, at least stellar black holes in global clusters. We now know at least there is one, perhaps more by now. I don't know, we're going to hear about Tom Macaron, the latest about that. How about massive black holes in global clusters? This is still a very active area of research. The evidence observationally is still tentative, I think. We're going to hear the latest on Friday morning. Theorists have built models where they now put massive black holes in clusters, and certainly these massive black holes can have very significant effects on the dynamics and structure of the clusters. In particular, they allow you to grow a core. Formation of massive black holes is also something that we've all, many of us, have worked on a lot. In fact, maybe a bit too much. I think we've shown pretty clearly in the last few years that it's actually quite easy to form massive black holes in clusters. There's a variety of ways to do it. I was somewhat relieved to see that there will not be a talk this week about runaway collisions and all that, which is one way of producing massive black holes quite naturally through successive collisions and mergers of massive stars in the early stages of the dynamical evolution. Another way is through successive mergers of stellar black holes growing to form a big one. I thought that was pretty much dead. The difficulty there, of course, is that merging black holes emit a lot of gravitational radiation, and they do that, especially at the end, in an anisotropic way. So merger products recoil. And we now know from the latest relativity GR calculations that the recoil speeds are very large enough to eject these things from clusters. But Kelly Holley-Bockelmann is going to give a talk on Friday that maybe adds a bit of a new twist on that. And there might be ways of still even resuscitating that scenario. Blue stragglers, it's the same story again. So the observations have made enormous progress. We now have almost complete samples of blue stragglers in many clusters, both in the central regions and in the outer regions. We have beautiful radial distributions of blue stragglers in many clusters. We even have spectroscopic data, in some cases with direct mass estimates. We understand the basic physics pieces. We've understood, I think, pretty well the hydrodynamics of stellar collisions now for many years. We understand at some fairly detailed level, thanks to a lot of work by a co-organizer, Alison Sills and colleagues, the stellar evolution of collision products. Where do these things eventually go in a column magnitude diagram? What we cannot yet do is put all these pieces together into comprehensive models that can really be directly compared to observations. And as a result of that, some very old questions are still there. The perennial question, for example, of whether boost stragglers really come more from direct physical collisions, sort of single-single collisions, or more from binary mergers or something in between, we still don't know. Now we're going to hear the latest, the pendulum has been swinging a little bit. The latest papers I've seen tend to say that it's probably more binary mergers. This will be debated again, and I don't think we're going to settle this question anytime soon. Okay, here's a last slide, the third area that will be addressed at the conference, and it's actually, in terms of number of talks, I think the dominant one. It's also the one I'm least familiar with because I don't work on this, so I'm going to be a bit more superficial and careful maybe. So this is the area of global cluster formation and trying to understand initial conditions and where do they come from. This will be most of Tuesday, actually starting a bit today already, and then most of Tuesday, all of Wednesday morning, and all of Thursday morning. You know, one way of asking a very simple-minded question is, are all stars really formed at t equals zero with this nice universal Kuiper-type IMF? For many years, this was, for a lot of us, almost the definition of a global cluster. Theorists would say, by definition, a global cluster is a dense system of n stars that were all formed at t equals zero in single burst of star formation with this universal IMF. Well, this is all gone now. And we're going to hear a lot at the conference about why this is really not true. We'll hear on Wednesday morning about the very, very exciting latest developments in the study of multiple populations in clusters, both observationally and trying to understand them from the point of view of stellar structure and evolution calculations. What we clearly know from the existence of these multiple populations is that at least in some systems, the star formation is clearly not just a single burst at t equals zero. It's in fact spread over a period of time that could be very significant, as much as a giga year or more. And a giga year is not something that anybody should think, you know, of shrinking back into an instant at t equals zero. This is very significant. We're going to hear about the many recent claims that the IMF, at the stellar IMF, at least in some places, but these are places that are very relevant to understanding the initial conditions for global clusters. Things like young, dense clusters, arches in our galaxy, things like these ultra-compact dwarf galaxies, which look like maybe very, very big global clusters. In all these systems, there's very good evidence for IMFs that are not just the standard Kuiper IMF with a saltpeter slope. Instead, they're top-heavy IMFs, where the slope at the high mass end could be much flatter, as flat as 1, maybe 1.5, instead of the saltpeter 2.3. That has very, very significant consequences for a lot of the, especially early stages of dynamical evolution of clusters and their survival to the present. And then sort of the an extra twist on that is the idea of primordial mass segregation, for which we have quite a bit of evidence observationally. This is the idea that the IMF is actually radially dependent and favors more the formation of heavy stars towards the central parts of the clusters compared to the outer parts of the clusters. Steve McMillan later this morning will talk about the dynamical consequences of that. So, just a few more words about cluster formation from two different points of view. I think for people who study the evolution of global cluster systems in our galaxy and other galaxies, the perennial question has been really, how is the present day cluster mass function, which we observe, related to the initial cluster mass function? And therefore, how can you take observations of global cluster systems today and learn something about global cluster formation? I don't think this question is settled. I think that's my impression from talking maybe too much to Steve. And it'll be debated again at this conference. And in particular, there is a panel discussion tomorrow afternoon. But I'd like to ask a slightly different question, maybe for discussion at this meeting. How can we really do this? How can we model or understand theoretically the evolution of global cluster systems without, and I would claim we are still without, a good theoretical understanding of the dynamical evolution of individual clusters? In particular, you look at some of the things that have changed recently. You know, if the IMF is really as flat as some people have said, well, we've known for a long time, going back to early papers, Chernoff and Weinberg, that this can have very drastic consequences for the evolution of a whole system of clusters and how they survive to the present. And finally, sort of the most fundamental question of all, how do global clusters really form? How is their formation related to galaxy formation, to galaxy evolution, galaxy mergers in particular? We're going to hear about that from a number of people later on in the week, particularly on Thursday, going all the way to the sort of most fundamental approach of all, which is really to do star formation, starting with hydrodynamic calculations. That's it.
Fred didn't want any questions. I think we do have time for one or two. So I'll go ahead and start, just so you get used to people asking questions. Can we use both of these?
Yes, yes, you can.
Okay, so this one should reside
out. Yes, one is for the chair and one is for the person asking the question.
Yeah, this should reside out here permanently.
Also, we should get into this habit. The next speaker can come and set up already, because we have a switch there, so you can already connect your laptop and then we just switch.
So I'll start the question I was going to say, since it's somewhat close to my heart, in the how can we model and understand the evolution of GC systems without a good theoretical understanding? I think some of the motive of individual cluster evolution, some of the motivation is if you understand it, if you can successfully model it with the current understanding of individual cluster evolution, then the system, if you can model the system with what we know now, it gives you some confidence that the modeling that you're using, the physics that's in that modeling, is not completely wrong in the context that you're using it. It's a way to actually test understanding of individual cluster system cluster evolution, is to see if it predicts the systems correctly.
Well, that's a little bit like saying that in the old days, again, I like the parallel with stellar structure and evolution, you know, you could learn really about constraints on stellar structure and evolution by studying stellar populations rather than looking at the sun or a few other individual stars and trying to build models that actually fit them. I still think fitting individual objects is a lot more important in constraining theoretical understanding than looking at whole populations. But of course, you know, I'm biased.
That's why we're both organizing. Okay.